Colin's Story, Episode 3, The Turning.
So, the guys were just no happy at all about us. I think they actually seen that we were scared. They must have done. They must have seen that we were scared. Well, they obviously never knew at that time again that we were soldiers. But they must have seen that we were scared, that it was just a completely new environment to us. And we asked them if we could go back to the boat, which they agreed to. As I had said before, these guys who were coming on to that boat were guys who had been coming on that boat since the day that we arrived. So there was obviously something going on between these guys and the crew or the captain. There was something definitely going on. We were later to find out these guys were drug dealers and they were more or less gangsters that we were getting involved with. We were told that later on by one of the crew guys, a young guy who I got sort of friendly with. And these guys did take us back to the boat. And when we got back, we were there for maybe another week or two, something along those lines. And it was decided that the boat, after it had been obviously, had been emptied of its cargo, would head back to Cyprus. And we had asked if we could go back in the boat to Cyprus, and it was decided by them that we could. So that in itself was a massive relief. At that moment in time, when they told us that they would take us back, we still were in sort of limbo. Are they going to take us back? Are they going to still kill us? Because that was always in our head. What we were going to do in Cyprus when we arrived there, that was a different story. We hadn't really thought greatly about what's going to happen when we get back into Cyprus. But I can remember seeing Cyprus and the shoreline and what have you, and it was fantastic. But like all boats, when they go into ports, the customs and excise or border security or whatever the case may be, they've got to dock way outside, maybe a mile or two before they actually go into port, which gives like say border control or whoever it is time to visit that boat to make sure that boat's not coming in with any illegal immigrants, for example, or carrying anything untoward. Even back in those days, they had to. This is where it all became very, very strange to me in reference to the passport. Because remember I told you at the beginning of the story that I was sending him on boats and nobody would take us because we never had any passports. And then he came off the particular boat that we did go to Lebanon in. And when I asked him about the passports, he had said, everything's okay. Everything's okay. So, before the customs came out to check the boat, the captain had asked us for our passports. I was really confused. Why was he asking us for passports when John had told me that everything was okay? Plus the fact we had told these guys in that flat that we never had any passports. They couldn't have been liaison with that captain greatly because that captain would have known that we never had any. So these guys who we had told that we had no passports, they hadn't told that captain that. For some whatever reason, I do not know. So the captain had said, as I said, the customs and that are coming out to the boat, can I have your passports to show them? So I then again had to say to the captain that we never had any passports. Well, he went cuckoo. So it ended up, we were put into the engine room, me and John. We were put right underneath these big, massive engines, as far into the engines as we could go. And customs had came onto the boat, had cleared the boat, and then we were allowed out from beneath the engines. So that was fine, and we were maybe about a mile from shore, and I was just wanting to get on shore, but the boat wasn't due into the port until the morning. So that meant we had to spend another night on the boat. And I remember I was pleading with the captain and the crew. They had dinghies. and we wanted to get a dinghy. And we wanted to go on shore, but they wouldn't allow it to happen. In the morning, the boat did dock. And remembering, of course, when we got back to Cyprus, we only had one set of clothes for the day that we went. Even one pair of socks, one pair of underwear. But what we used to do in Lebanon was we'd wash, every night we'd wash one thing and they had radiators in the boat. So we managed to keep ourselves clean to the best that we could. So the boat did dock and basically we just walked off. Me and John just walked off without any hassle. We got outside the docks and we had met two guys that we had known within the army. They were in the same regiment as me and they had since got out the army and they had decided that they would stay in Cyprus after finishing with the army. They knew us, obviously, and we got talking to them and they were telling us that everybody had been looking for us and where were we? We're in Cyprus somewhere. Although I wasn't in Cyprus. That's how they couldn't find us. And they, one of them had happened to say to me, which he knew anyway, he could remember me having bought a motorbike when I had went to Cyprus. And he was asking me about that motorbike and how did I get it on HP, which I had done. And I was paying back the Cyprus Popular Bank in Limassol that money. And he was asking me about this. And I told him, I am paying back Cyprus Popular Bank, or at least I was. But because of what's happened, I've made no payments whatsoever toward that bike. I just abandoned that bike before I went to Lebanon. So this is what the guy told me to do. I walked into the Cyprus Popular Bank in Limassol. I made myself as presentable as I could. And I walked into the Cyprus Popular Bank and I went up to the cashier type of desk and I said to the person behind the desk that I had been on leave in Cyprus, in the UK for some considerable amount of time and I've fallen behind in payments for my motorbike. And she said, that isn't a problem. I says, aye, and I would like to pay money toward that. She then asked me about a bank card, which I never had. I says, no, I've not got anything like that. As I say, I've just arrived back. I says, everything's in the camp. Just getting any excuse that I possibly could. That wasn't a problem. She said, I did have a Midland Bank checkbook for some reason. I'd taken that to Lebanon. And she asked me how much I wanted to pay toward the motorbike. And it was a few hundred quid. And I wrote this cheque out. And I handed it over to her. And the next thing I seen her just counting this money out. Now, I remember taking on board, these guys told me to do this. And I remember she counted this money out. And she gave me it. And it was in a downstairs bank, the Cyprus Popular Bank. She gave me all this money. And I've been absent for 6 weeks. And all this money's coming to me. And we've just arrived back. We're only back half an hour. We've got all this juicy lolly. And then she said to me, just go up the stairs and that's where you'll pay your bike. Well, I did go up the stairs, but I never went to pay my bike. I went into the toilet and I waited a few minutes or so, came out the toilet, walked down the stairs and walked right to the bank. And I had all this money. I felt like a millionaire. And John was all excited, so we went on a spending spree, we bought clothes, we were staying in hotels, no big fancy hotels or anything like that. It was a few hundred quid, but it was a lot to us. It was even a lot of money then, to be perfectly honest with you. And that's what we done. We went on a spending spree, hired a car and what have you. But that money obviously ran out. So we had to do it again. And I said, I can't do it again. I says, because by this time, clocked on what has been happening in some form. I said, you're going to have to do it again. So away he went with the same scenarios. And I'm sitting in this mini, I always remember it was a blue mini. And I was sitting in this mini and he was away for ages. And I seen him coming back and I'm looking at him. He gets into the car and he sits in the car and he went like to me, I can't do it. I can't do it. I said, you're going to have to do this. I says, we've not got any option here now. I says, we're as well handing ourselves in right now. I says, so you get out of that car and you get into that bank and you get it done. Poor guy, right? And away he went. For the second time and again, I was sitting and he came back and I just remember looking at him again and his thumbs went up and I was like, yeah, beauty. Got in the car, so that was us away again. But we knew we couldn't do it a third time. No, that was totally... No, we were lucky to get away with it a second time. So a third time would have just been... No, it would never have happened. So that money was running out. We were in Ayanapa, in actual fact, at this point. And we were drinking in a British bar called the Union Jack pub. Well, it would have to be British, wouldn't it? And during that time, we got to know holidaymakers and... We pretended to them that we were tourists and things like that, and we were doing a bit of work in Cyprus, just anything except tell them that we were in absent rather for the forces. And money was running out. And I remember we were in a hotel apartment, we had been out during the day, and this particular day, we're in the hotel apartment, and the both of us had fell asleep. I woke up and John wasn't there. Now, Ayanapa at that time was quite small. It isn't like it is today, where it's a massive tourist resort. But nothing like that. Ayanapa was relatively small. Small enough that you could actually walk around Ayanapa in the town centre and not get lost, so to speak. And I woke up and John wasn't there. And I was wondering where he was. So I decided that I would go looking for him, as I did. And the next thing I see is him sitting in this restroom with this, which ended up to be an English couple. And I was like to myself, what is he doing? So I goes into the restaurant, and I remember I had enough for a bottle of beer. And I gets the bottle of beer, and I sits down with him and this couple who were on holiday in Cyprus. And I got his attention and made him come to the toilet with me. So we got into the toilet and I said to him, I said, right, what's going on? What's happening? He said, well, I woke up and you were sleeping. So I decided just to go for a walk. I bumped in to this English couple, he says, who were on holiday. They asked me to go for a meal. I told them that I never had any money and they said to me, listen, it's okay. We'll take you for a meal. So I said to him, I said, that's brilliant, eh? Unknown to me what was about to happen. I says, that's brilliant, eh? And he's like, aye, so it's back down at the table. And eventually, John had got up to go to the toilet, but he never came back. And I was wondering, I said, where is he? And this couple went like me, your pal's away an awful long time. So the guy got up to go and see if he was all right in the toilet. And the guy came back and he went like, I said, listen, he says, your pal has bailed out the window. He says, we wouldn't bother about this, but we met him in the street, right? And he offered to take us for a meal because we never had any money. Because we never had any money. Oh, my God, I could have killed him. So I just jumped up in this restaurant. And by that time, the staff in the restaurant knew something was going on. And I just jumped up and I bolted out the restaurant and I heard one of the staff shouting, they're soldiers, or worse to that effect. And he was nowhere to be seen. I ran to that pub, the Union Jack pub, and I was puffing and panting when I got in. And these guys who were on holiday, for Leeds, I think they were, you know what I mean? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? Oh, nothing. And eventually, I'd got a drink. They had bought me a drink, and I'm standing there. And that's when I eventually told these guys that I was actually known Cyprus on holiday. I was actually absent for the British Army. By that time, it was 8 weeks, 6 weeks in Lebanon, 2 weeks in Cyprus. And I told them that I'd been absent and an incident had happened when I rushed up the road, and I'm just telling them that. And the next thing I knew, there was two MPs walked in to the Union Jack, and they more or less came right up to me. And they went like to me, excuse me, sir, can we have your name? And I was still in a bit of denial for some reason. I turned around and I said to them, I says, I'm not telling you my name. I says, I'm not in the army. I says, so I don't have to answer any questions at all to yous. So away they went, and I turned around and I said to these guys, I says, listen, I says, they'll be back. And the guys went like to me, well, if they're going to come back, why don't you just bail? And I was like, nah, there's no point. They did come back, but they brought two civilian police with them. And the two civilian police came up to me and said to me, or asked me for my name. I can always remember the name I gave them. Don't know where I got it from. I just said, Colin Anderson. I says, I'm a tourist. I says, and the police were like, well, listen, an incident happened in a pub, and we're arresting you in suspicion of this incident. But we need to see your passport. I said, my passport's up in my hotel apartment. Well, you're going to have to come with us because we want to see it. So they did. They took me in their Land Rover, and I was followed by the MPs in their Land Rover, gets to the hotel apartment, walking up the stairs. I'm in the front, they're behind me. I went in my pocket to get the keys, just put the key in the lock, never unlocked it totally, and just turned round to them and were like, right, okay, my name's Colin Carroll, army number, regiment. I've been absent for 8 weeks. So that's when I was handcuffed and taken to prison to be interviewed. They wanted to know where I had been, how I'd got there, what happened whilst I was there, what have I been doing since I came back, all that sort of stuff, right? Once that interview was over, they took us to a military jail. And I met this guy who I'd previously known, Mitch, his name was. He had been in for some time in the jail. He had done everything in his power to get out of the army, but for some reason, the worse he got and the more undisciplined he got, they just wouldn't let him out. And he said to me, he said, listen, do you fancy a scheme? I was like, are you having a laugh? I says, I've been absent for 8 weeks. I says, I've been in here about half an hour, and you're asking me if I want to escape? And he's like, aye. He says, I've worked it out. He says, I know exactly what to do. So I was like, well, I may as well, because I'm going to jail anyway. I said, so I'm as well going out on a whim. Right? So, that's what happened. I escaped along with Mitch for the jail, and then we headed during the night to Limassol yet again. We headed there, and another thing, we were going to go with the idea, we'll go to Nicosia and we'll say we were tourists in Cyprus, lost our money, lost our wallet, and hopefully we'd get away with it. Again, we would never have got away with that. So we were in Limassol and we were cleaning ourselves up because we came through this sort of woods and places like that. We were pretty dirty, and there was a fountain in Limassol, and we were sitting washing our shoes and cleaning our hands and making ourselves decent for this thing going to Nicosia. Unknown to us at that time, we had been watched. We were being watched, but it was unknown to us, so we cleaned ourselves up and we started to walk. And the next thing, these two cars just came to a screeching halt, and these guys were all jumping out, and everything was just kind of turmoil, and I'm up against the wall, and Mitch is up against the wall, and they're saying we're being arrested and suspicion of housebreaking. And I was like, I'm shouting at all this, what the f*** are you talking about? Housebreaking? I says, we're tourists. We're tourists. We've done nothing wrong. I'm laughing, but that's kind of... And they arrested us, and they took us to CID. It was CID who actually arrested us. And they took us to their offices in Limassol, and I remember I was going in to get interviewed, and this officer was behind his desk, and he was like to me, he says, listen, he says, Colin, he says, we know who you are. And he showed me a photograph of myself, and I went like, oh, well, caught again. Put back into the jail where I'd escaped from the night before. But this time was different. It was different in the reason that, to me, I had voluntarily got caught the night before in that pub. You know, I had basically surrendered because I could have run away. But then that, the next night when we'd been put back into the jail, it was completely different. So much so that I got assaulted in the jail. I refused to soldier, which meant that I was refusing to put on the Queen's uniform. It's as simple as that. And I was assaulted. I was stripped naked. I'll never forget that. I was stripped naked and I was made to parade in front of other soldiers with no clothes on. That, when it happened, it was really, really degrading. And I had turned round and I had said to them, as it was happening, I said, listen, I'll put on the uniform, because I was just pure embarrassed. And I did put on the uniform. But then I decided that I'm not letting this go. This at this point was nothing about being gay. This would be going on to a different level. It was about me being gay going absent, but that was all within myself, remember? And so this assault that I was given was nothing to do with me being gay. It was because I had escaped from the jail. So in other words, they weren't stopping me. So maybe they were feeling a bit peeved off of themselves, eh? How they could let two people escape from jail. So I decided to put the uniform on. And we decided, because we were put into solitary confinement, but there were times that we did see each other, me and Mitch, and we had decided a day or two later or something like that, when we managed to get talking to each other, we decided that we'd go on hunger strike and protest, because Mitch got stripped naked as well. And we decided to go on hunger strike against the army, the way that they treated us. It didn't matter if we went AWOL. It shouldn't have mattered. We should never have been put in that position. You know what I mean? It was degrading. So our protest was that we would go on hunger strike. And that is exactly what me and Mitch had done. Difference between me and Mitch was, Mitch had decided not to take food nor water. I had decided that I would take water. Now, I'm not a medical person, but with Mitch not taking water and food, not so much the food, because you can live 3 months or something without food, something like that, but water's a different ballgame. Water's a thing that you've got to take. So we did start the hunger strike, and Mitch was on no water, no food. And it was the third, maybe fourth day Mitch got rushed to hospital. That's when I decided, hell with this, I'm going to start eating and what have you. But I was still protesting, even though I took food and water. Mitch, incidentally, he ended up all right. I was seriously angry with the army. I had threatened the army, no matter how long I get in jail, when I get out, I'm going to go to every newspaper that I can get my hands on, and I'm going to tell them what you's done to me. So I continued to protest and continued to be kept in solitary confinement, only getting out for showers, very little exercise, anything like that, and threatened them with newspapers. I do know that they were starting to panic, you know what I mean, because they didn't want me bringing the army into any form of disrespect, you know what I mean, so that was important to them. They weren't wanting this kind of thing to go on. So I'd been called to see his orders. And I knew what it was for. Well, it was about the crime that I had committed. I knew it wasn't because they gave me a kicking in the jail. I knew that. I knew it was something they made me going absent and what have you. And because I wasn't playing ball, I can remember the RSM trying to quick march me to the commanding officer's office. And I was like, get yourself lost. I'm talking to an RSM. I says, I'm no marching for you. I says, I'm walking. And that's it. I strolled. I mean, you go into a commanding officer's office and you're up in orders of some kind, you've got to come to attention or that. I just walked in. And the RSM screaming at me, you come to attention. I was like, get yourself to f-. That's all. I wasn't caring anymore. I mean, I wasn't taking what they were trying to tell me what to do after treating me like an animal. So that first time I went up, I got further remanded in jail and remanded for an abstract. That means that I'm going to be, sorry, I'm going to be court-martialed. It's not as easy in the British Army just to court-martial somebody if you're a commanding officer. A court-martial's quite a big thing. It's got to come for London, it's got to come for MOD. A commanding officer can't just say, I'm going to court-martial you. That's got to come for hierarchy, it's got to work through the system. And that's why they call it an abstract. And that's exactly what happened. So I knew that I was going for court-martial. And it was running up to Christmas by this point. And things like that, and still in jail, obviously. And Christmas came, Christmas went. We were into about February. Aye. We were into about February at this point. That would have been 2004. And I was going up in front of the commanding officer again. And I knew this time what it was for. Or at least I thought, this is me, I'm going to get my debt for my court-martial. I'm going to Colchester in England. I'm going to jail for at least 2 years. But through all this time, in remand, so to speak, I'm still threatening them that I'm going to the newspapers. I'm not changing my mind. I don't care. I'll do what I thought would have been 2 years. I'll do my time, but I'm still going to, and I was adamant I was still going to do it. And I thought I was going up exactly for that, to get a date for my court martial to take place. And I'm standing outside the commanding officer's office, and this carry on again, coming to attention and sir and all that. And nah, I wasn't caring. I just walked in. And I'm just standing there, just like, I'm just, you know, just relaxed. I wasn't caring about the army. I wasn't caring about anybody or who they were or who they thought that they were. And the commanding officer, he turned round and said to me, I'll never forget it, he turned around and said to me that I was going to be immediately dismissed for the British Army. I would be taken to RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus, transported to Bryce Norton, and I'd be released for the British Army. So there was no court martial. And I turned round and I went like that to him. I says, no. I said, no, no. I says, you're no fobbing me off like that. I says, I want my court martial. He's like, but we're just dismissing you. I says, I don't give a f- if you're dismissing me or not. I says, I want my court martial. Oh, and it was just an uproar. Right? It was just an uproar. And the RSM shouting at me, saying, what are you talking about? You're out of the army. I says, I'm out of the army. I said, no. I said, because I threatened to go to the newspapers and you're just trying to get me to shut my mouth. I says, I might be young. I says, but I'm no stupid. I says, so I want my court-martial, but as it happens, I never got my court-martial. And I did arrive back in the UK, and I was dismissed for the British Army. I was raging, and at this time, what you've got to take into consideration, this was got nothing to do with being gay. Well, it was in my own head, but no, as far as the Army was concerned. In my own head it was, this all started because I was gay, this all started because I was verbally abused and getting called names, this is where it started for, but I've still not revealed this, because it went on to a different level about me getting assaulted and stripped naked and that. So this was a different level altogether. And I did arrive back in the UK and I was dismissed for the British Army and I was raging and I was sad that I had to come to this, you know what I mean? My name would be tarnished because people would have thought that I went AWOL, as I've said before, think that I'd been scared of the Army and scared of different things that happened in the Army, which just wasn't the case. And I got out and I did go to the newspapers. They still weren't getting away with it. They thought, we'll dismiss them. And this will all just be slid under the carpet and we'll hear no more about it. When it was published in the newspapers where I'd done my training in Glencore's barracks in Edinburgh had approached the Army in Glencore's barracks and said to the Army what I had said about the Army and the way that they had treated me. It was totally, totally denied with the Army. And that was printed on in the paper. It was a lot of rubbish that I was talking. No, I wasn't letting it go at that. I still wasn't letting it go. I went to my local MP, who at that time, strangely enough, was the Labour spokesman for the MOD. He was my local MP, Martin O'Neill, if he's still living. That was his name. And I had told him what had happened to me. And I had told him that I wanted to take the Army to court. And I can always remember what he said to me. He said to me that, listen, you're taking on a big company. You're taking on the government. I says, I don't care. I says, I want to take the Army to court. I says, I'm admitting I went AWOL. I'm admitting that I escaped from jail. But I'm not going to say that I never done that. That's got nothing to do with this. So I can take my punishment for that because I was guilty of that. That isn't my protest. My protest is the way I was treated. That's my protest. The Army should not be allowed to do things like that to people. You know what I mean? Even today, I believe things like that go on. We all hear past news stories, people commit suicide, people doing this because of the abuse within the services. You know what I mean? I'm speaking out here about this because I'm speaking out for future people who might be in similar situations, about talk about being gay and things like that. You know what I mean? I want to speak out for people. And Martin O'Neill, getting back to him, I never heard from him again. I never heard from him again. I was in Civvy Street. That was me. I had ended back in that wee village where I'd started from. I'd ended back there. Still, obviously, yeah. I was back to the beginning.
The following organisations provide information and support for some of the issues raised in this episode. For further details, please look on the Stand Easy website at standeasyproductions.org. Fighting With Pride supports the health and well-being of LGBT+ veterans, service personnel and their families, in particular those most impacted by the ban on LGBT+ personnel serving in the armed forces prior to January 2000. For more information, visit fightingwithpride.org.uk. Rock to Recovery is a charity for veterans and their families that provides rapid preventative interventions, specific coaching and assistance, including the provision of short and long-term refocusing support for veterans leaving the service with brain injuries and mental health issues attributable to their period of service.
To find out more, visit rocktorecovery.co.uk. Combat Stress is a charity for veterans' mental health. They help with mental health problems such as post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety and depression. They provide specialist treatment and support for veterans from every service and conflict, focusing on those with complex mental health issues. You can find more information at combatstress.org.uk.
Veterans First Point is part of NHS Scotland and the Armed Forces Community Covenant. It provides free advice and support for anyone who has served in HM Armed Forces and their families. For more information, visit veteransfirstpoint.org.uk. Colin's story was told by Colin, a Stand Easy participant in October 2020. It was recorded and introduced by myself, Jade Anderson, and edited and produced by Sandy Jamieson. This project was funded by the Community Fund, the Veterans Foundation, the Armed Forces Covenant and the Northwood Charitable Trust.